All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the final day of ELI. Our first speaker this morning is Kyle Bowen, who is the Director of Educational Technology Services at Penn State University. Prior to his move to Happy Valley, he was the Director of Informatics at Purdue University, where he did many different things focusing on creating and cultivating innovative uses of technology for teaching and learning. As part of Purdue's Studio Projects initiative, he oversaw the development of a comprehensive suite of learning tools that sought to address academic challenges experienced by both faculty and students. He is a relentless pursuer of technologies that hack the classroom and is a regular speaker on educational technology, publishing presentation art that editorializes the latest educational technology trends at classhack.com. In addition to all those things and his administrative responsibilities, Kyle taught undergrad classes on public speaking and science writing in Purdue's Brian Lamb School of Communication and has co-authored and edited more than 20 books on web design, development, and usability. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, USA Today, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. Please welcome him this morning.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. Thank you very much for such a kind introduction. Again, my name is Kyle Bowen. I'll be starting as the director of ETS at Penn State on Monday. So this is one of those rare scenarios when you see that little blurb under somebody that says, you know, views are my own and no one else's. I can say that and actually mean it. So what I want to talk about a little bit this morning are these kind of big ideas. The thing is that these aren't necessarily things you haven't heard of before, but rather it's a different way of looking at things that we've already been doing. Now, something that you don't know about me is that I love to take road trips. Now, I don't mean those road trips that you took in college that maybe you don't quite remember. I mean those road trips you took with your parents that you wish you didn't remember. These were the trips where you'd ride in the back seat of the family car with your brother or sister battling for control of the line. Oh, we all know that line, right? It's that seam that runs down the middle of the back seat. It creates a no-fly zone separating two halves of the car. Many a battle has been waged over this line. Now, my parents, in an effort to draw a truce between my sister and I, they invested in travel board games. You see, the idea with travel board games is simple. You take a regular-sized game, and then you shrink it down until it's not really fun anymore. If you thought Monopoly was frustrating before, wait until you're playing it with a pair of tweezers. And Connect 4 travels well enough, but the pieces were so small, we were losing them all the time, and after a while we're playing Connect 3, and let's just face it, that's tic-tac-toe. You see, we have faced a similar challenge in our move to new technology. We've taken so many of these things that we used to do, and we just apply technology in a similar way, right? We just take what we were doing before, and then we shrink it down. But see, what we're faced with is this idea that things change, and then there are things that die off, right? Things like fanny packs, things like waiting in line, things like conversation. Is conversation dead? I mean, it certainly would be imaginable. I mean, simply look what it's up against. Mobility, text messaging, social media, the internet, these are the four horsemen of the talkpocalypse. Conversation never really stood a chance. You can't like a conversation. You can't post it on a wall. You can't put it in a circle. You can check in from a conversation, but you won't be getting any badges for it. Nobody ever became mayor of a conversation. You can't really save a conversation, not without being kind of creepy about it anyway. And you can't search for a conversation, although I'm sure it's not due to Google's lack of trying. But you see, the real death punch for conversation came from the fact that it was no longer mobile. Now wait a minute, how can that be? The whole point of a mobile phone was to enable conversation at any time. Is your phone about talking to other people? I bet every one of you has a friend that if we called them right now, they would never answer. But if we texted them, well, they just text us right back, right? We all probably have a friend like that, and if you don't, maybe it's you that I'm describing. What does that say about your relationship? Well, I gave you my number. I didn't want you to actually call me. Or, I don't, you know, we're friends, but you're not more than 140 characters interesting. Or if you ever used your phone to actively avoid a conversation. You're walking through, let's say, Target. You see that person that you went to high school with. You didn't like them then. You don't want to talk to them now. So what do? Well, you just pull out your phone and pretend to have a conversation, right? My slides are going wonky. Sorry about that. So you just kind of walk on by because I've dialed numbers and everything, you know. But of course you're making it up because, well, who talks on their phone anymore? And then there's always that situation that I know I had in college where you'd be sitting in a coffee house, but really it was a bar, and then all of a sudden this song would come on, and you would debate with the people around you, is that Kenny Loggins or is that Two Live Crew? We can't quite be certain. But now we empirically know, right? We can get out our phone and find out that we all like the same Justin Bieber song, right? We no longer have to have those idle conversations about the weather. No longer have conversations about where to find the cheapest gasoline. Now we know. So I ask, is conversation dead? No, it's not dead. It's just been reinvented, right? We have different kinds of conversation now. And that's so much of what we need to look at in terms of learning technologies and their shift with technology. Is it's not so much that the old way has died. It's just it's been reinvented, or at least it needs to be reinvented, and looked at a slightly different way. Now, in this case today, what I want to talk about are four basic ideas around different technologies and alternate ways of looking at them, right? And so what we want to do is kind of lift those up and say, okay, here's the idea. How would it be applied as a way to kind of generate a conversation around what are the applications of the technology? First one I want to talk about is the second screen. Now, some of you are using similar types of technology now. Maybe you actively use it. Most of it comes from television networks. So the USA Networks, Bravo, HBO, Showtime has these. Disney has some really interesting ones where the app will use the audio track from the movie you're watching to determine what point in the movie you're at. And what it does is it surfaces or delivers additional content based on what you're watching. And it could be a wide range of things. So it can say, look, because you're watching this television show, here's a discussion of people who are watching the same show. Here's some background information on that character. Here's background information on this particular actor. And oh, here, by the way, you can also buy the shirt that they're wearing. Right? And it creates that second screen experience because what television networks know is that they are in a battle for eye time. Because it used to be that you would watch TV, and you'd have maybe your phone or tablet, and you'd be watching TV, and you'd glance down at your phone. Well, what do you do now? Right? You're reading your phone, and you glance at the TV. So really, we have to begin to argue which one is actually the second screen in that scenario. Right? We can begin to apply similar concepts inside of the classroom. Right? That classroom experience, the expectation is something like this, right? That I'll just be blown away by the awesomeness of the knowledge being shared. Right? But in reality, it's maybe more like this. Right? Still being blown away in just different ways. Some worry about something called the cone of distraction. The cone of distraction is simple. It says that if you have a student sitting in the front of the classroom with their laptop open, that it will create a cone-shaped area of distracted students behind them. Now, you can actually calculate the size of this cone where radius 1 is the screen diagonal of your laptop and radius 2 is what I call the probability of PowerPoint. It says that the more boring your PowerPoints are, the wider that cone will tend to get. See, these are all things that begin to influence how we look at that live classroom experience. But one of the greatest changes has been as the students have brought technology with them, it changes that interaction. But the fascinating part of it was nobody ever asked them to. Nobody ever prescribed that technology. They self-selected it. They decided for themselves what was the tool they were going to use, and now in many cases they're bringing with the bandwidth on which to use it. That very much changes our dynamic. We're getting beyond just this kind of mindless use of the technology, but we're really beginning to seek this interconnectedness between our students, right? They tend to look like this on the sidewalk, though, right? Just kind of wandering around, maybe wandering into the street, running into a sign or something. We've all seen it, I'm sure. But the idea of that discussion is not necessarily new. I mean, we've had back-channel style interactions for quite some time, enabling students to have conversations in real time inside of the classroom while lecture's going on. But what we can do is begin to change this idea and do more than just engage in conversation, but rather create that second screen style experience. But what some worry about is this idea of damage being done as part of that conversation. The comment grenade, right? If we let anyone say anything they want to, well, then they're going to say anything they want to, right? What happens when damage is done? This is a great example that I use all the time, and I really like it because it encapsulates kind of a progression of a conversation. This is an actual back-channel conversation. Happened in a class about personal finance, and it was a discussion about investment bonds. And the first student question, and these are the actual student posts, what would be considered a good interest rate for bonds? Okay, question begins to build on the material. The next question, are bonds the pieces of paper so often sold in the movies? 10 sheets equals 3 million, and Jodie Foster's hiding in a panic room. Right? So the student's making a connection here. Is that, okay, this bond thing you're talking about, is this like the thing I see in the movies? Panic Room's a great movie, by the way. Are bail bonds a form of investment? Or only there to get a drunken buddy out of jail? Well, maybe this one, too, they're relating to a past experience. You can't quite be certain. But certainly there's a question in there. Okay, so somebody's making money on bail bonds. So, you know, there's a conversation to be had there. And then the last one, which is Craig is the most badass bond, which, of course, refers to James Bond, or Daniel Craig, the most recent James Bond. But the problem is that we all know that Connery was the most badass bond. So how is this a big idea? So what? We've been doing this. Well, here's the big idea. More lecture. Right? It's weird when you begin to advocate for the obvious and in so doing trying to be conspiratorial at the same time. It's like saying, hey, we should breathe more, right? But the problem here is that we get so far beyond the things we're already doing, right? So if we, instead of calling it lecture, let's call it a flipped MOOC, or call it a flipped classroom, or something like that. There is so much value in that live experience. It's the difference between attending the concert and listening to the concert, listening to a concert recording, right? But what we can do is use the technology in the space to begin to create a better live experience. So at the end, that's what we're beginning to advocate, is advocating or extracting all of the value out of the live experience, because it's an expensive proposition, there's no doubt about it. Having a group of people physically occupy a space gets expensive. So if we're going to have them there, let's extract all the value out of it that we can. But let's begin to look differently at how does that change, how does that interaction occur differently, just like it did with television. It was no longer I'm just consuming a front channel of information. Now I'm consuming multiple channels of information based on my own interests. To brutalize a couple of cliches we like, it's a guide on the stage and a sage on the side, right? That it becomes my choice in terms of how I want to consume that live experience. Moving on, the next is to look at kind of going beyond the idea of ebooks. So, you know, the traditional idea of education is, you know, gone virtually unchanged. You know, it used to be the guys wearing the togas standing in front of the white columns, and now the only difference is, well, we still have, you know, the big white columns, and we still have guys in togas, except for they're at the frats. But now the guys in the togas publish books, so you have the choice. You can listen to the guy in the toga, or you can buy his book. Right? That's the kind of major evolution that has changed there. But the problem is that despite the fact we have better technology now, we have not really progressed past the book. We've done what I talked about first in the introduction. We've taken it down and we've shrunken it and just put it on a smaller screen. Right? It's the same stuff we had before. And with the technology we have, this is like using a horse to pull your car. Right? The technology is far more capable than what we're using it for. So part of what we have to look at is just kind of the varied nature of what we have. There's this long tail effect in terms of content. something I describe is what I call it the Weekend at Bernie's principle. Anybody seen Weekend at Bernie's? Yeah, right? So the Weekend at Bernie's principle basically says that every movie is somebody's favorite movie. And we know this is true because Weekend at Bernie's had a sequel. So somebody must have liked Weekend at Bernie's. And if somebody liked Weekend at Bernie's, then there's a movie out there for everyone, right? And the same thing is true when we look at our content. There is this long tail of content. There is content there for everyone. And what we have to do is kind of transcend this idea of it being fixed media. It used to be when we talked about fixed media, we were talking about print media, but really now we have fixed digital media. It's been baked into a PDF file that never changes. What we need to do is kind of embrace this idea of open content that's remixable, that's shareable. Again, not all new ideas. We also need to adopt this notion of timeliness of content. This was one of the best examples I've ever seen dealing with timeliness of content. A professor who teaches veterinary science needed to share MRI imaging of a dog. And which was compelling because, well, you know, you can get a lot of MRI images, but the challenge was, how do I get it of the actual dog that's in my clinic so that I can connect the material that's being captured in the clinic with the animal itself, right? This is what it means to be timely, is that there are things or forces that happen outside of the classroom, in this case a sick animal, that require the changing of the course material on the fly. Right? So how is this new? Right? We've had open content, we have interactive content, we've had ebooks. How is it new? Free is a terrible business model. Plain and simple, we have to have a better business model for how we deliver textbooks. And it has to be more than just a nominal price difference. Right? The difference, so we can look at reducing prices on a textbook so we can make a $120 textbook $80. It's still $80. Right? So how do we make it even less? But the problem is coming up from the other end is free. Free is very difficult to sustain. Right? It costs a lot to make it free. So there's a novel business model in there that says, well, what if it were a nominal cost? What if you charged a nominal cost for open resources? Then suddenly we have a way to make it regenerate. We have a way to sustain it over a period of time, and we've made dramatic improvements in the cost of the text. But also in so doing, by using open content, by taking advantage of these digital platforms for crafting it, we can enable so many of those other ideas that we can have a wider variety of content that's not been genericized, that is openly available, and it's also immediately applicable in the case of the veterinary science content, right? But again, we have to revisit this idea that there's an answer that exists between free and discounted, right? Let's just call it dramatically cheaper, something like that. The next thing to look at is the notion of big data, right? There's a few Trekkies in the crowd who are getting it right now. That's always good. They're almost a little bit ashamed without covering their mouths. That's good. So the idea of analytics that we've been talking about for a long time, and the thing is, we shouldn't really get hung up on this notion of big data, because let me just explain it to you in a very simple way. There's this notion out there that you've probably heard of before, that rats are just squirrels with good PR, right? Have you ever heard that before? Well, let me tell you this. Big data is just math with good PR, right? It's the same concepts, things we've been applying before. It's just a different way of applying that data. So we shouldn't get hung up on how big is the actual data, or how much are we talking about, or how is it, or how are we assessing that data, or who is the person who is doing it. These are all nuances that kind of describe the act of, let's take information we have now and use it to support people with. Use it to make our business better, right? At Purdue, we worked on signals as a way to do early intervention, and this is so much of the focus on analytics, which is identifying students that could be at risk. And this is very important work, and I don't for a second want to diminish that. But the thing is that we can do more than that, right? We can use more of the information we have rather than just identifying students who may be at risk, but rather begin to enable them in new ways. So is the case of Target, right? You've probably heard this story before. The young girl who's receiving coupons from Target in the mail because Target had detected, based on her buying patterns, that she might be pregnant. And so they start sending her coupons for pregnancy vitamins and formula and these kinds of things. But of course, she's living with her parents, and her parents are getting these things in the mail. And so her father gets upset and calls Target, "Why are you sending these things to my daughter?" Well, it turns out she's actually pregnant, right? They've taken what they knew and they applied it. And in this case, it's in a very socially complex way. But the same types of opportunities exist inside of that model. Really, what we're beginning to do is not just identify the ones at risk, but rather identify the potential in everyone, right? Because what we're doing is identifying the Waldo in a sea of Waldos. It's not necessarily we're looking for one in a sea of people doing other things, but yet they all begin to look very similar. So that becomes our challenge, is how do we use this in new ways? Now, one of the areas that I've researched with colleagues is dealing with question relevancy. So students ask questions. It's a basic form of help-seeking behavior. Right? But the interesting part is that some questions are better than others. We all know that. That some questions, I should say, are more relevant than others to what's going on inside of the classroom. Now, what we found in our research was that you can actually predict, based on the question, based on the person asking the question, and based on the material in the class, you can predict the relevancy of that question. And you can determine how relevant it is based on the class. Now, if we can do that, that means that we can then surface more relevant questions for immediate answering while dealing with the other ones either after class or in other times, again, extracting more out of that live experience. We can begin to collect like questions together. We can begin to identify collections of students who may be struggling with particular similar concepts. And then the next one being something like this where, you know, we've all probably been to a website before where you have that password strength. You know, you have to use the numbers and the letters and the uppercase and the punctuation, and it'll tell you how strong it is based on that. You can have a similar concept with questions so that you find out as you're asking it, what is its relevancy, right? And then it begins to teach you how to craft more relevant questions, right? These are all concepts of just beginning to apply what we already know about how people interact. Right? And it's a different idea around enablement. Using big data, using analytics around enablement and not necessarily enforcement. This means giving students their own data, giving them their own insights about how they're interacting with material. Right? And it has to truly be the insight. It can't be, well, you've been reading this ebook for 6 hours. Is that a lot? I don't know. Well, maybe it is, that, you know, depending upon how others are reading the same material. What is it suggesting about how you're reading that material, right? What we have to do is identify how do we reveal insights to students themselves the same way that we would help faculty or the institution reveal the same insights. And then, as a corollary to that, should the student have their own data for their own analysis? That gets interesting real quick. So what if they have their own data? So many of these students, this is their field of study, right? Should they be able to dissect it themselves? It's kind of like going to the doctor and getting your own MRI data and going home and self-diagnosing, right? It's dangerous and empowering at the same time. But it's an interesting question to look at in terms of how do we support our students. The last one I'm going to talk about is open badges. So the idea of grades, right, been around for a long time, A through F. But the interesting thing about grades is that, well, they're actually a lot like badges, but they're just kind of lame badges. They're this blunt instrument that we use to apply to learning that has happened, right? And there's some measurement that we use, application of this idea is, okay, you sat in the class, you've met a particular measure in a way I've wanted you to, but yet, so I give you an A, but really there's no real difference between the A I gave to you and the A I gave to somebody else. Right, you just both met the same measure. And then we recognize that on a transcript. Right? So at the end, you get this transcript. Hey, here are all the classes that you've taken and the scores you've gotten, which looks remarkably like one of these. Right? So what we begin to do is we've measured now. We've assigned you a number of credits based on the amount of time you spent in the classroom, based on a measure. But none of those things yield what did you actually learn? Right? So this is where the badge comes into play. And this is really the kind of meat of it, right? That we have the badge, which is the iconic symbol itself, really not that different from a grade. But underneath it exists all of this additional information. And the key of this being the evidence, right? That's the interesting part about badges, is that they really are just kind of the tip of a bigger iceberg. The badge, the part you see, is just the top. The real meat of it is all the evidence that supports it. The thing that demonstrates the learning that actually took place. That's the interesting part of it. Now, from an infrastructure standpoint, what we look at is issuing and displaying. As institutions, we are what we generally refer to as an issuer. Right? We have the badge, we can issue it to a student. They can then take that badge and they can display it in other ways. But then what it also allows is other people can also issue badges. And what it means is that you can begin to collect different types of experiences and begin to display them together. So your transcript of learning is no longer just where did you get it from one institution, but it's a more holistic picture of learning that's taken place in other places. And we can also look at badges in a different way and look at them as goals. We can look at them specifically as instructional goals. We can look at badges as ways of identifying participation, and we can look at badges as ways of recognizing skill development. Right? All of these things become different applications of the same credential inside of this environment, which really starts to speak to the versatility of these particular badges. Right, and all the different ways that they can be applied. Now, part of what we have to look at is that it gets us beyond the course clock. Right? The race that every student runs, whether it be 16 weeks or 15 weeks or 8 weeks or however long it is, it's a race. You start on day one, you're racing to complete the necessary amount of work in the necessary time. And at the end of your semester, somebody will evaluate your work and determine, okay, you have achieved a C. Because that's the level of work that you've completed, not you're currently at a C state, and here's what you need to do to complete the course. Or put another way, only pass part of a class. Right? That was an interesting concept where in fact I began to think about, well, if I have three learning outcomes in a course, it's possible for a student to not achieve two of them and still pass the class. So how do we begin to think about the course clock differently? Such that we're looking at the specific outcome that needs to be achieved as opposed to just kind of meeting the time on the clock. Now, there are lots of different ways of applying badges, and these are just a couple of examples. They can be applied in a curricular sense. So in this case, these are badges that happen that identify outcomes within a specific class. You can use them in a cross-curricular way, so you can look at outcomes that exist in across different courses and use that as a way to recognize a broader competency that wouldn't be recognized by any one individual course. We can begin to look at co-curricular aspects. So in this case, this was an interesting program where students had developed a LinkedIn, the LinkedIn boot camp, where they helped other students develop their LinkedIn profiles as part of seeking employment. And then the other one being open curricular activity. So as we continue to offer, MOOCs or other forms of online learning that is non-credit, how do we begin to certify or recognize that, even in an informal way, such that it can be intermixed with other more formalized credentials? Right? So the real value here, though, is that we can, from an institutional standpoint, so many of these ideas already exist inside of our institutions. Right, so what we can begin to do is retrofit the idea of badges inside of the academy. Right? We don't necessarily have to say, well, let's stop doing all this other stuff and start doing this. We can begin to apply, like the examples I showed before. Every one of those things were things that were already happening. Co-curricular activities, your courses, these kinds of things, badges can be fit into those environments. So it doesn't mean stop doing all these other things you were doing before, but rather apply this as an overlay. So how does that end? Transcripts out and badges in, right? Rather than giving you a receipt for your learning, for your education, thank you for coming. Here's a list of stuff. Let us know if you need help to the parking lot, right? We say, look, here's what you learned in one nice, easy-to-use interface that is now mineable by employers so that they're not just kind of sifting through resumes. They're really looking at the whole of the student and able to pinpoint specific competencies that may be related to what they're seeking in a particular student. So Now we have to look at broadly, how does this apply? So much of the use of learning technologies is we begin to seek this out and begin to apply it inside of the classroom. That's where we begin to engage our stakeholders, right? So for any new technology, we have the same challenge, which is the technology adoption curve. We have early adopters on one end, laggards on the other. And what I would suggest is not just automatically running to the early adopters, but actually kind of looking at the entire curve. From my experience, the from a faculty standpoint, they tend to exist at ends of a spectrum where at one end we have the five, which are the faculty into virtually everything. We all know these folks. They're the most fun to work with, right? But the problem is they're into everything, right? But then at the other end of the scale, you have the fave, or the faculty against virtually everything. So, but what I advocate for is adopting both ends. In one case, one, you can hit the ground quickly. In the other case, you're looking at somebody who's very prudent about putting the technology in place. They're specifically looking for value. Why is it that they don't like it? Right? Because that's even more valuable than the person who will just adopt it. Right? If you can get that critical feedback. But at the same time, you can't just seek that end of the scale, because at the same time, it helps to have some context in which to apply it. So that's the other kind of concept here, is that as we begin to flush out these new ideas in terms of how to apply them, is that we look at the entire scale, not just those people who are advocating change, but really even those who aren't. Why is it that they're advocating something different and beginning to understand those concepts? It's again based on this idea that change, innovation, isn't a place you go, right? Welcome to innovation. We have beanbag chairs. Right? It's not something we can just easily do, but it's actually more of a deliberate, planned act to make change. And so what we can begin to do are apply, take these ideas that we already have, and begin to think them and look at them in different ways. So many of these things weren't new ideas. All of you are probably familiar with you. Many of you are probably already implementing them in one way or another. But it just becomes down to, how do we look slightly differently at how that technology is applied? And in an effort to try and change and make difference actually on the ground to the student and for the faculty. I think I've done enough damage today. Thank you very much for your time this morning. I really appreciate your attention. There are microphones here. Do you have any questions? Yeah. So if you'd like to use one of the microphones, you're welcome to ask questions. How much time do we have? Yeah. Okay, cool.
Good morning. Thank you for your presentation. And I was one of the people who did not cover my mouth in shame at the data, the big data.
Good for you, sir. Proud track.
I wanted to ask you a question about big data and see if you could talk a little bit more about the application of that to the students. Canvas has within it the ability for students to see their progress throughout the class in this analytics. The teachers have the ability to do that too. That seems to me to fall somewhere just beyond the just give them numbers, but not quite to where you were talking about as to what kind of data we want to be giving them. Can you talk a little bit more about what type, like how would you do this? What type of data are you talking about?
Sure, and that's an excellent question. So it's dealing with so many of the things we have now where we do begin to present information to our students. And so really what I'm saying is that we are at this critical point where there are so many applications for the information that we can't know what they all are. We can't place bets in every place simultaneously. So what we have to do is look at it slightly differently and say, okay, what if we empowered people to kind of do it on their own, but at the same time provide the insights? So it's not necessarily that there's like one outcome in there. It's to say, look, there's a broad range of outcomes. So part of it may be inside of your learning management system, you'll have that telemetry that'll tell you, you know, basic analytics about how a student's logging in or how much time they're spending on their course, how they're engaging inside of those discussions. But at the same time, that's not necessarily providing an insight. That's just giving you telemetry off of your car. It's like the difference between, whether I have gas and what is my fuel mileage. Right, one suggests something about my driving, the other one is just the state of my car. And so that's where, really ideally where we need to get to, or is that idea of providing an actual insight that is actionable more than just having the information. But the other end, which is the complete end of the other end of that spectrum, is providing the data itself. If a student has the data, their own data, to begin to figure out and explore, then what information or what can they glean from that that we can't? What can they begin to see creatively inside of that data? And so it's kind of like apply that same kind of makerspace thinking to data. Allow them to craft individually on their own and experiment and see what is it they can learn from it that we can't. I have another question back here.
First, big up to you on the presentation. The artwork is really fantastic with a lot of depth and humor, and I really enjoyed that a lot. But that makes me think about badges. So I could give you a badge for doing a great presentation, but I don't get the depth of the goodness without seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, as you pointed out, grades are already a lot like badges, or I have transcripts and their course descriptions, and you can get certificates and endorsements and things attached to degrees and so forth. But an e-portfolio can give me the actual artifacts where I could, you know, read your papers and look at your artwork. So I was wondering if you could make a quick maybe comparison between the value of the e-portfolio and the access to the actual artifacts like big data and a badge, which is still subsuming experience under a credential. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So that is a fantastic question because it really begins to pull together a lot of these ideas. So to the first question about, you know, that idea of, well, if you were going to create a badge related to presentations, then really what it would need to do in order to be effective would be to contain the evidence of that presentation. So essentially the presentation material and a video of the presentation itself would be attached to the actual badge or the credential. So that would be the fundamental difference, whereas a grade would just be the letter, whereas a badge would actually have the evidence contained within it. Now, its relationship to e-portfolio is an excellent question because that's kind of the interesting way of looking at badges is that in many ways they're like a kind of sneak attack on e-portfolio. It's a way to achieve those e-portfolio concepts without kind of the burdensome notion of e-portfolio. Because a lot of what happens with badges, and the real opportunity in there is as we begin to develop learning systems around badges, is that it captures evidence at time of creation. Right, that's the key, because otherwise it becomes an exercise in archival ability, right? That you're digging through old files trying to find things you once did, you know, which is a very cumbersome process. So in many ways, badges will become either tightly integrated with e-portfolios or become e-portfolios themselves, and that's really, I think, a lot of it. And then the other point you made, which was, I think, fantastic and right on. By doing so, it in itself becomes a new source of data. It becomes a new source of information about how students are learning at a learning outcome level as opposed to just at a course level. So we can look at how students are performing versus our expectations of how they perform, these kinds of things, and it looks at a much more granular way. And so it's a very interesting way of approaching that. So that's where you begin to see kind of the cross-pollination of some of these ideas. Question online? Great.
I have a question online. And if you are going to get employer to mine the data inside the badges, how do you get the buy-in from the employers on a grand scale?
How do you get buy-in from employers?
Yeah,
so that's a trick. So there's a lot that's going on already with multiple different groups that are interacting with employers. Institutions who are experimenting with badges are working with their employers. The Mozilla Foundation, which has really been one of the real supporters of badges early on, has been working with both the government and potential employers. But the key becomes the, you know, nobody bought DVD players before there were DVDs, right? So that we're kind of at that same conjunction point where we're saying, look, we have this identified need, which is more information about the student, but yet we can't begin to consume that until there's enough critical mass in terms of the number of badges and the quality of badges being issued. And so I think, but once that day comes, you know, from an employer standpoint, they would certainly want to seek the most information they could get. And from a student standpoint, that means that, because currently there's not like an easy way to share your transcript, nor would you necessarily want to. But in this case, you can craft your portfolio of work based on your interests, based on your skill sets, based on the things you're strongest at. And also in things that don't get officially recognized, things that aren't a part of your transcript. Things like, you know, if you were president of the student government or part of different leadership organizations, these kinds of things, which have no real official recognition, suddenly now have a way to recognize that. Any other questions? Oh, well, great. Again, thank you very much for your time this morning.